Hello, this is Maria. As a small business owner in Juneau, I found the section on entrepreneurship fascinating. I came from a line of business owners, servicemen, and farmers, and I strongly believe because of them, I am. I would like to share just a tiny piece from the women entertainers and the service economy of the Gold Rush era. As tens of thousands of men looked to the north for fortune, women also realized that opportunities might be found in Alaska. In 1896, just as the Gold Rush began, Betsy Couture opened her black and white restaurant in Skagway. Her modest restaurant was the first known black-owned business in Alaska. While thousands of men participated in the Gold Rush, a small group of women contributed as well. They may be among the most overlooked of all the participants, but they left an incredible mark on their respective settlements. Some labored in Alaska throughout their lives, but most made quick money and moved on. Mary B. Mason, one of the first blacks to reach the Yukon, left Seattle in early 1897 and briefly staked a claim at Hunter Creek, not far from South Central's settlement of Kinnick. The records do not indicate where Mason was born or where she came from, but she migrated to Seattle in the mid-1890s with the intention of traveling north to Alaska. She eventually returned to Seattle in August of 1898 and brought with her over $5,000 in gold dust. Another black woman, Mrs. D.B. Verdon, never worked a claim, but prospered nonetheless. Instead of mining, she operated a hotel just outside of Nome at Gold Run. Prospectors rented rooms for $109 a month, a large sum for early 20th century. When she returned to her hometown of Des Moines, Iowa, after a 13-year stay in Alaska, the local paper proclaimed, "Negress returns from Alaska with a million." Charles and Lucille Hunter traveled from American South to Fort Wrangell on the Stikeen River in 1897. Lucille Hunter was 19 years old and 9 months pregnant when they arrived in Alaska. She named her child Teslin after the lake next to where she gave birth. Her husband died months later, but Lucille Hunter decided to stay in the Yukon and brave the conditions as a single mother. She worked a claim just outside of Dawson and a silver claim in Mayo. She also opened the cozy lunchroom and eatery that served bread, sandwiches, and desserts. Another black woman, Sarah Robinson, operated a chicken ranch and laundry in Eagle along the banks of the Yukon River. While tales of charlatans, boxers, and miners conjure a frontier spirit often associated with the Wild West, so does the world's oldest profession. And like most remote outposts where men vastly outnumber women, prostitution flourished during the Gold Rush and beyond. Few knew the business better than Mattie Tootsie Crosby, an African-American woman who came to Alaska from the booming metropolis of Chicago in the early 1900s. After a brief stay in Skagway, Crosby hiked the Chilkoot Trail to Dawson City. After a few years in Dawson City, Crosby moved to the small settlement of Iditarod in 1910, where she lived for nearly 15 years. In violation of federal alcohol prohibition, Crosby established a bootlegging operation. She served a 6-month jail sentence in Fairbanks once the prohibition enforcement officers caught up with her in 1925. Too often, we are unable to access the voices of the women, men described in the previous pages. Instead, what is known about these figures has been meditated through the memories of others in newspaper accounts, or even from law enforcement records. But sometimes an unexpected voice provides a fresh and direct perspective. In 1899, Clifford C. Hancock traveled from Chicago to Fort Gibson, Alaska. He lived at the confluence of the Tantana and Yukon Rivers and worked as a butler and family assistant to Captain Charles S. Farnsworth, the commanding officer at the fort. Hancock penned an article for the Colored American magazine in August of 1903. Hancock's article, "Alaska, Unalaska, and Other Points of Interest," stands as the earliest known firsthand account of the territory written by an African American. He made his way from Chicago by rail and then traveled to Aleutian by a steamship operated by the Alaska Commercial Company, reaching the interior via the Yukon River and viewing the settlements and communities as far as Eagle. Now, whether it's Hancock's first-hand account or the second-hand accounts from soldiers, miners, trappers, sex workers, innkeepers, and pugilists, all convey the disparate ways of in which black men and women contributed to the social and cultural life of Alaska at the turn of the 20th century. This suggests a more multiracial territory than many assumed. Like most Western outposts, one would find vice, prostitution, and illicit businesses in Alaska's gold rush boomtowns. Here, too, African Americans made their mark on Alaska.
Faith in God has always been a part of the Black culture. In times of trouble, our people ran to the church, to God, to the preacher. There they found comfort, peace, wisdom, hope, joy, and strength to keep on moving. The same can be said of our people in the early 60s in Alaska. Still to this day, if you were to ask about the preachers in early Alaska, the name Dr. Reverend Alonzo B. Patterson would come up. This is a name that is certainly familiar to me and holds a special place in my heart because this is my grandfather. Born in New Orleans, Louisiana, amid the Great Depression, Alonzo Patterson's life has long been centered in the religious community of Alaska's Baptist Church. Like many others, Patterson came to Alaska with the military and arrived in 1962, just 3 years after statehood. Ordained as a minister in 1960, Patterson presided over the Corinthian Baptist Church in Fairbanks for 7 years before moving to Anchorage to become the pastor of Shiloh Baptist Church in 1970. He led the congregation at Shiloh Baptist Church for 47 years. In that time, he witnessed Anchorage change from a town dominated by a white population with a rather small black minority to one of ever-increasing diversity. The Shiloh Baptist Church, located in Fairview, has long been a central institution in Anchorage's black community, thanks in large part to his stewardship. Patterson has served as president of the Alaska NAACP. In 1996, he and Anchorage Mayor Rick Meyerstrom founded the Bridge Builders, which connected Alaskans and forged harmonious communities within Anchorage's increasingly diverse population. Patterson also chaired the Martin Luther King Jr. Foundation in Alaska. In 2017, Patterson stepped down from his role as lead pastor at the Shiloh Baptist Church, but he has remained active in and around Anchorage and continues his outreach with an emphasis on Black men who have been historically underrepresented in the local economy, state, and local politics and business. Thanks in large part to his efforts, Shiloh Baptist Church remains an indispensable institution. For his part, Patterson stands among the most recognizable figures in Alaska's faith-based community. I am honored to share just a few of the accomplishments that Reverend Patterson has achieved, and even more proud of the matriarch he is to our family. A strong foundation of wisdom, protection, faith, and love.
Following World War II, Alaska followed a similar trajectory of racial inequality and civil rights activism as the rest of the country. Let's review some accounts of the rough and wayward path of civil rights under the Northern Lights. These accounts have been taken from Chapter 5 of the book Black History and the Last Frontier by Ian Hartman. Most of the information presented is taken verbatim from the book, with edits for clarity and continuity. An early account of this path is the story of Beatrice Lee Chisholm. One evening in October 1946, she went into a bar in Fairbanks, Alaska, and the bartender and owner, Rudy Hill, said, "I have a license that gives me the right to refuse service to anyone, and I see fit not to serve you, and my reasoning for not serving you is because you're colored." True, it was not the Deep South or the large cities of the Lower 48, but the battle for civil rights under the glow of the Northern Lights demonstrates a continuity in the nation's black freedom struggle, be it in the North, the South, or Alaska. This event started Beatrice's fight for justice against racism in Alaska. Now, the Alaska Territorial Legislature passed the Anti-Discrimination Act in 1945, 1 year earlier. The forces behind the pressure to pass it were the Indomitable Roy and Elizabeth Paratovich. Elizabeth is probably best known for her eloquent testimony before the legislature on behalf of the act. It was a pivotal moment in the history of Alaska race relations and the making of a broader Native coalition to challenge white dominance. The story usually ends optimistically with the passage of the legislation and a well-deserved celebration of Paratovich as an Alaska civil rights icon. The truth ever grows considerably murkier once we include the story of Robert and Beatrice Coleman. In fact, without the activism from the Colemans, the Anti-Discrimination Act of 1945 would have remained largely ceremonial. So the story continues with the Colemans trying to sue to have their rights, which were also acknowledged by law, protected. Unfortunately, few lawyers wanted to take on a discrimination lawsuit against Hill, the racist bar owner, a figure who enjoyed prestige in the community as a business owner and entrepreneur. Even though there were several complaints against him and he was issued a misdemeanor and fined $50 by a Fairbanks police officer, Hill's conviction was overturned after he went to court. He and his lawyer contended that it was perfectly acceptable to vocalize discriminatory views and refuse service on any basis he deemed fit. The law did state, any person who shall display any printed or written sign indicating a discrimination on racial grounds shall be guilty of a misdemeanor. Following Hill's win and subsequent overturning of his misdemeanor, Coleman approached Warren Taylor for help with her case because she believed the intent of the Anti-Discrimination Act was clear, to provide for a full and equal accommodation. With Taylor's help, the Colemans also recruited Emma Roberts, a black Fairbanks resident, to testify against Hill. As strong evidence was piling up to suggest Hill routinely violated the law, the U.S. attorney filed a warrant for his arrest, and he would have his day in court. Arguments in the court case began, and a rather stunning turnaround, Rudy Hill convinced Warren Taylor, the Colemans' representative, to represent him rather than them. And while Hill managed to change Taylor's mind, he did not convince the U.S. attorney who ordered him to pay the fine. Rudy Hill continued to appeal the case. Beatrice Coleman changed direction and went to the territorial governor, Ernest Gruening, for relief. Unfortunately, Gruening and Attorney General Ralph Rivers openly noted that while the law had good psychological effects, there was no guarantee that the Colemans case could prevail in court. In short, even the most influential politicians in the territory expressed little confidence in the ability of the Anti-Discrimination Act to prohibit discrimination in public places. Following Hill's appeal, the court sided with him and dismissed the case a year later, after this ordeal began in November of 1947. To add insult to injury, in the days following the court's decision, the local paper failed to cover the case and instead ran a feature advertisement for Hill's Bar and its quote-unquote generous atmosphere. Despite its thorough documentation and in spite of the court's unwillingness to intervene, Beatrice Coleman turned to the legislature. Alaska Territorial Senator Edward Anderson of Nome recognized the omission in the legislation that he actually helped produce, so Anderson and his colleagues introduced a bill to amend the Anti-Discrimination Act by removing the phrase "for each day which a sign is displayed," which would effectively close the loophole that Hill used to skirt justice. The amendment passed unanimously in the Senate. The House of Representatives passed the revised bill 18-3. Continuing with the stunning, unjust turn of events, Warren Taylor, the Colemans' former lawyer that switched sides, was now serving in the House and cast one of the three no votes. As we have seen and will continue to see, Alaska followed a similar trajectory as did the rest of the nation, and we were not immune from racial discrimination, segregation, or financial inequality, despite our distance from the lower 48. But many in the state wanted to feel that way. Ernest Gruening, when he penned his 1954 manifesto, audaciously stated not one untoward incident was reported subsequent to the enactment of the Equal Treatment Bill. He must have failed to realize that the untoward comments had come to him a few years earlier, where he stated to the Colemans that there was nothing in this bill that could stop undue discrimination.